That's good. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the History on the Rocks podcast. This is your host, Cody, and of course, joining me, the wonderful, now 33-year-old, Audrey.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back.
Audrey just turned 33 on Monday, so happy birthday, Missy.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, sorry, everyone. We were up in Canada. We left last Tuesday and got home Sunday, and I was supposed to put an episode out, but we just never got time between that Sunday and Tuesday to ever record it. So that's my fault. But we are back this week with a brand new episode, and today we're going to be talking about two new ridiculous conflicts in history that are kind of ridiculous for different reasons. But first, what are you drinking over there?
I got some Savvy B, Kim Crawford.
Kim Crawford.
What do you got?
Oh, I'm so excited for this. So this is my favorite Canadian beer. It's called Sleeman. I first had it when I was 19, the first time we went up to Toronto, when our family friends had moved up there. And I haven't had it in so long. I think it's been like 8 years since one of our friends got married up there. And I brought two cases back with me, and it is so good. So if you're ever up in Canada and you're a beer drinker, I love Molson. Molson's great. Labatt's is fine. I can drink Labatt's too. It's just like our like Budweiser, Bud Light, right? I shouldn't say that because Molson's better, I think, than Budweiser. Sorry. as pro-American I am, Molson's definitely got the upper hand on Budweiser. But Sleeman is fantastic. It's just, it doesn't taste like a bitter lager like we have as like a domestic. You know what I mean? It's very like rich in flavor for a beer. So whenever we go up there, I try to bring some back because you can't find it in the States. They don't sell it here. So very pumped to have it.
Well, I'm not a beer drinker, but let me just take a sip of it.
Okay.
I mean, I'm getting better, but not with these kind of beers. Mm. And I asked what kind. Why is there no thing on here?
It is. They don't have a label. Theirs is like etched into the glass.
Oh.
But this is their original lager. It says it on the top part.
Oh, yeah. I don't like it.
Audrey can't drink it.
too beer-like for me.
Oh, see, I think it's so good. But yeah, I'm very pumped to have it. Yeah, see, it says Sleeman Brewing.
Yeah,
and it's got
like
the maple
that.
Leaf in the middle.
I didn't notice when you were drinking them before that there's no sticker or whatever.
Yeah, the sticker's on the top here.
Well, yeah, but ours have sometimes both.
Yeah. Yeah, this one's cool, though, that their glass is etched like that, and then they have the label at the top that tells you it's 341 milliliters.
Nice.
Which is 12 ounces.
I'll say, but their, like, bottle is shaped a little bit different.
Yeah, this is
like
more
wider.
This is more shaped like a pirate rum bottle, almost. Like this wider neck, and then fatter belly.
It's not as slim.
But I think this is kind of specific to Sleeman in general, because if you look like at a Molson, it doesn't look like this. Molson's like fatter all around and then has a neck. This bottle itself, I think Sleeman's been using this type of bottle for a long time, because
nice.
I recognize it from the first time I had it. And it changed a little bit, but still so good.
All right.
Well,
let's get into it.
Sure. Our first ridiculous conflict of this episode is called the War of Jenkins' Ear, and it's very appropriate, and I actually had written this. Oh no. I didn't even think about that.
You weren't thinking that? Okay.
No, now that you just laughed, I'm not thinking about the attempted Trump assassination over the weekend. Actually, where I was going with this, that it involves Great Britain and Spain. And I was saying the good timing of it that I didn't know before was England just played Spain in the final of the Euros in soccer on Sunday.
Nice. My mind went somewhere totally
And now
opposite.
That you just said that, I feel like I made a totally tasteless joke, and I did not mean it that way. But yes, we all, I think, if you're living under a rock, if you didn't know, there was an assassination attempt on former President Trump. And yes, his ear was pierced by a bullet. And in this story, yes, Jenkins' ear gets cut off. Oh. So I guess that is appropriate too for this weekend. Double appropriate, Saturday and Sunday.
Yeah.
No, but I was going with the rivalry between the English and Spain in the soccer game.
Okay.
Not so much the assassination attempt on Trump's life. So That was not my intention there, so please don't take that out of context. So the War of Jenkins' Ear, though, is a conflict, like I said, between Great Britain and Spain that lasted from 1739 to 1748, just before the American colonies, waged their revolution on Great Britain. It's named after the incident in 1731 when Robert Jenkins, who's a British sea captain, allegedly had his ear severed by Spanish coast guards, which we'll get to in more depth. But the incident is used as a rallying cry by the British, although the actual reasons are far more complex and tied to broader geopolitical and economic tensions. This one incident became like the big rally cry. So if you think of our no taxation without representation, right, in the American Revolution, Jenkins' ear was like their rally cry against the Spanish during this time because of his ear being ripped off 8 years prior to this actual whole conflict starting. That's kind of the one ridiculous part of it, is just like the fact that one man got his ear taken off, but the threat was given directly to British government and King George II personally by his ear being taken off. So what the background and causes are here is there's a lot of maritime disputes happening. So if you don't know what maritime disputes are, that's, trade over the water, right? Maritime is anything that happens on the water.
Yes.
Tensions had been brewing here between the British and the Spanish over trade and territorial disputes in the Caribbean and in the Americas. The Spanish were keen to protect their monopoly on trade in their American colonies. So basically, Spain, right, they colonized pretty much all of Southern America, all of Central America and Mexico, and then the Caribbean, with the exception of the Dutch and the Portuguese in some of those areas. But what we're talking about here is that the Spanish particularly want, obviously, Spain's goods coming to the Caribbean and the Americas to bring back money for Spain.
Yeah.
Right?
Makes
but
sense.
England, what they're trying to do is their merchants are trying to expand their own trading opportunities over to those southern areas of the Americas as well, because they have the colonies already, right? At this time, the 13 colonies are established under British rule. And now the British don't just want to trade with the colonies. Now they're trying to also trade with these, the people that the Spanish have conquered.
Yep.
Right? So the indigenous people, anywhere from Honduras down to Venezuela and Ecuador, all the way down to Argentina. So the British are looking to expand their trade here.
Mm-hmm.
And the Spanish don't want them to come at all, right? Because it's going to take away from all the riches that they're taking back to Spain. It's competition. So there's a monopoly there that the Spanish have with trade. The incident with Jenkins happens in 1731 when the Spanish Coast Guard boarded Jenkins' ship, accused him of smuggling. During this confrontation, Jenkins' ear was cut off by a Coast Guard soldier, and he was told to take his ear to the British king and warn the king that if you're going to smuggle, this is going to happen to your king as well. So it was a direct threat using Jenkins, which was really interesting because what we have to understand here is that British ships, because the Spanish were not allowing trade, British ships were coming down to the Caribbean anyway and smuggling in items. And basically this confrontation between the two created this giant black market to where people were buying things under the table from both the British and the Spanish, but mainly the British who were trying to push out their goods and services down in the Caribbean and South America at the time. And that's kind of the ridiculous part of this as well, is that both governments had agreed to sign these two what are called asientos, which are like agreements, right? There's the Asiento de Negros, which allowed Britain a monopoly to supply 5,000 slaves each year to the Spanish colonies. And then there's the Navio de Permiso, which permitted a single British ship to take 500 tons of trade goods to the annual trade fair at Portobello. The British government granted a monopoly for both of the agreements of the South Sea Company, but other British merchants and bankers also wanted access to, obviously, the Spanish markets that were thriving and the Caribbean. So the Spanish colonists, in turn, desired British-made goods And the result was a thriving black market in smuggled goods between industrious merchants in both countries. And that quote comes directly from the Warfare History Network, warfarehistorynetwork.com. So you get a better understanding there of, like, what has happened. Mm-hmm. There's an agreement.
Yep.
The agreement pretty much says, okay, we're going to allow you to supply slaves to the Spanish colonies, and we're going to allow you to have a ship that's able to come with 500 tons of goods, and you can come to Portobello and make as much money as you can.
Yeah.
But the thing is, and why Jenkins' ear got sawed off, was that the British were still sending smuggling ships into the Caribbean unknowingly. And the other agreement from British Parliament, though, was that they allowed the Spanish to take over their own ships. So basically, the British government, right, King George II, he said, listen, we're going to try and stop the smuggling because it's not good for either of us.
Yeah.
Right? We want to make money fairly, whatever. And the Spanish, we want to be able to access your goods. Mm-hmm. So he says to the Spanish, if you see any British vessels, you are allowed to board them and make sure they don't have contraband or they're not smuggling anything into Spanish waters in the Caribbean or South America.
Hmm. Interesting.
Why would you make that agreement?
Yeah, I don't know.
Because what ends up happening and why this war breaks out is that the people back in Britain start to realize that the Spanish are overtaking these ships and they're taking British citizens, right, who are just merchants. This is their job. Yeah. They're not soldiers. They're not anything. Mm-hmm. The Spanish are boarding them, stealing their goods, and then taking them captive and making them slaves in Spanish territories.
Huh.
So this reaches back to Britain, the news that this is happening.
Yeah.
And the king gave the order to the Spanish
it.
To be able to do it. Like, well, you didn't think, you thought the Spanish were going to absolutely just
totally honest,
be fine with it? Like, that's why they're one of the biggest rivalries even in soccer today, because their history goes so far back when both of their empires are striving. And these type of ridiculous conflicts that could have been probably, you know, talked and delegated better.
Yeah, for sure.
Because they're doing these, like, under-the-table agreements, and then bad things are happening to British citizens, and then you're also losing economic gain.
For sure.
Because Spain's just taking...
Kind of bit them in the ass.
Yeah, they're taking free goods off your ships that they're claiming to be contraband or smuggling.
It isn't, probably.
But here's the kicker. Most of those boats were sending legal sugar over to the Spanish colonies. So the Spanish were saying that, like, no, this was contraband, but it wasn't. This was actually a legal trade agreement between the British and the Spanish to have sugar from England come over to the Caribbean islands and South America, right? But then they were boarding these ships and saying, oh, this is contraband, we're taking it, and you're all prisoners now, and we're going to use you for slave labor.
Well, King allowed it to happen to his people, so...
There is also a something that actually impacts the United States in the future. There's also dispute at this time over the Georgia-Florida borderline, in which there was a lot of disagreement of where the border between Spanish Florida and British Georgia, where that line
Florida,
actually
Georgia
was.
Line.
Yep, the Florida-Georgia line. So there's a lot of conflict there as well, a lot of fighting broke out as to who owned what and where that border was actually established. Which was really interesting as well.
That is interesting.
One of the most significant engagements was the British assault on the Spanish port of Cartagena de Indias?
Indias?
Well, whatever. It's Colombia in 1741. This attack, led by Admiral Edward Vernon, ended in a decisive Spanish victory, which is never good for the British. Because this type of battle shows the Spanish power in the Americas, especially the Caribbean and South America.
Mm-hmm.
And England doesn't lose many wars. They don't lose many battles either. And this is a really dark time in British military history because, obviously, after 1741, they're about to lose the colonies in the next 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very... this relationship, I guess, with the Spanish is just like really odd to me that they're trying to force themselves into the Americas, but they can't even hold their colonies in North America, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you can't hold 13 colonies accountable to you and loyal to you, how are you going to take on a giant empire that's just as big as you?
I don't know.
So the war,
they could.
Yeah, the War of Jenkins' Ear eventually merged into the larger War of the Austrian Succession, which is 1740 to 1748, which involved many European powers within that area. The conflict between Britain and Spain became just one theater in a broader war. So this War of, again, Jenkins' Ear, all this trade and maritime battles, built up this rivalry so much against the or between the British and the Spanish that it carried over into mainland Europe. Okay.
Yeah.
The Treaty of Aix-la-Chapelle. I'm pretty sure the X is silent. Aix-la-Chapelle, 1748. The war ends with this treaty. It restores the status quo to before this war. Neither side made significant territorial gains, and the underlying issues of maritime and colonial competition were left unresolved. So basically, they wasted 20 years in the long run. They wasted about 15, 20 years fighting over territory and trade. And after this Treaty of Aix-la-Chapelle is signed, everything goes back to the way it was before. There's some military lesson here to be learned. The war highlighted the difficulties of long-distance colonial warfare and the challenges of maintaining supply lines and effective command structures over vast distances, which makes complete sense because fighting a war long abroad and over colonies that are already established is definitely not a good idea. You're probably going to lose that 99% of the time.
Mm-hmm. It's pronounced X.
Oh, it's Aix-la-Chapelle.
Yes.
Thanks for looking that up.
Yeah.
Aix-la-Chapelle. I just feel like that's French, and like the X would be silent, like Bordeaux.
Yeah.
And then again, we were talking about the continued rivalry between Britain and Spain, setting the stage for, again, the conflicts in the Americas and Europe that will happen in the future. So this is considered a minor conflict in British and Spanish history, but it's like the foreground to a much broader colonial battle and war between the two European nations. And it, again, showed that colonial competition and how geopolitical maneuvering can characterize a period and force these conflicts that sometimes have no real resolve.
Yep. For sure.
Well, that's the story of Jenkins' Ear. And it all started with the loss of an ear and the threatening of the British king from the Spanish. The next ridiculous battle has to do with the British again.
All right.
I know. I'm doubling up the British story here. But this is called the War of the Golden Stool. But it is officially known as the Ashanti-British War of the Golden Stool, or in Ghana, the Ya Asantewa War, which took place in 1900 in what is modern-day Ghana. It was a conflict between the British Empire and the Ashanti Empire, which triggered British attempts to capture the Golden Stool, which is a sacred symbol of the Ashanti people. So basically what the stool is, it's actually a pretty interesting story, right? It's a relic, okay?
Okay.
It's literally a golden stool, and it's not a throne. It's more of a symbolic piece of the Ashanti people, in which they usually put it up on a wall.
Mm-hmm.
They call it the Wall of the Dead, because they believe that the dead souls of the Ashanti rest on that golden stool.
Okay.
So it's a very sacred piece.
Yeah.
It's a very sacred piece, and, you know, you're kind of thinking, like, it's just a stool. But it's 100% made out of gold, and it's very sentimental to the Ashanti people.
Yeah.
Okay? I think that's the biggest point to take away from this story, is that it's not just a golden piece of artifact. It is a very sentimental, religious piece of their culture.
Yeah. Spiritual. Maybe.
Exactly. If you don't know anything about the Ashanti Empire, that's okay. But it's a very large empire, which was established in today's Ghana, modern day Ghana, and was a very powerful and wealthy African kingdom before European colonization. It's known for its gold and its military prowess. So a military that could fight with some of the best European nations on earth.
All right.
The Golden Stool, also known as Sika Dwa Kofi. I know Kofi is the African word for gold, because I've taught that in AP Human Geography before. Like I said, is the spiritual and cultural heart of the Ashanti people, which symbolizes their unity and sovereignty. Now, the British, of course, late 19th century, are expanding their colonial territories in West Africa, and after several conflicts, including the Anglo-Ashanti Wars, the Ashanti Empire became a British protectorate in 1896. So the British basically make an agreement. It's not a colony, right, mm-hmm. per se. It's an agreement that the British will have a relationship with the Ashanti, but they're giving them a broader European power of protection against other European powers.
Okay.
So it's this kind of like give and take, I guess.
Yeah.
But in hindsight, it's just a foot in the door to mm-hmm. completely colonize the Ashanti.
Okay.
Even though this agreement is made, tensions remain high, and the issues of autonomy for the Ashanti and control of their territory are what is really at stake here.
Okay.
So do the British actually control the territory, or are they just helping the Ashanti? That's mm-hmm. basically what they're trying to figure out. The Ashanti yeah. people are trying to figure out, right? Do we still have autonomy? Are we still our own empire that is basically making a treaty or an agreement to be protected by a greater European empire from, mm-hmm. you know, Spain, France, whatever?
Yeah.
There's a man, there's always a man, that is named Governor Frederick Hodgson. And in March of 1900, he demanded to sit on the Golden Stool, believing it to be the throne of the Ashanti king.
Oh, that's not what it is.
Nuh-uh. Now, this act was seen as a grave insult to Ashanti culture and sovereignty, which sparked outrage and resistance among the Ashanti people.
Understandable.
Yeah. So, the ridiculous part of this war is that it starts all because Governor Frederick Hodgson demanded to be able to sit on the Golden Stool in order basically to show British power.
Yeah.
Now, I don't really know if he knew the context of the stool.
Mm-hmm.
He believed it was a throne. And like I said, the Ashanti people did not think of it as a throne. Yeah. Only the Ashanti king was allowed to sit on it during specific ceremonies.
Okay.
But I believe Frederick Hodgson believed it to be like a king's throne.
Mm-hmm.
When really,
he wanted to show his power.
Exactly. So, the king of the Ashanti is exiled. He's ousted. There is the queen mother, Ya Asantewa. And she is the Ashanti's new ruler at this time. She's the protectorate of the stool now that the king has been exiled by the British. And she's pretty badass. According to the Africa Defense Forum magazine, which is really cool. They have a lot of cool stories in here. She basically called the Ashanti warriors a bunch of bitches because they wouldn't fight the British for their sovereignty and to protect their land, yeah. right? So she takes over pretty much. And what she tells them is, listen, we have our kingdom to protect.
Yep.
We're one of the wealthiest African kingdoms. We're one of the most powerful military kingdoms in Africa. And we're just going to roll over and let the British
take over
through this agreement. They just exiled our king.
Yep.
And she's basically like, well, I'm in charge now. So are you guys going to cower up in the fetal position and let the British do it to you? Or are you going to get off your asses and fight? And this is a direct quote from the queen. She says, now I see that you are afraid to go forward and fight for our king. If you, the chiefs of Ashanti, are going to behave like cowards and not fight, you should exchange your loincloths for my undergarments.
Put on my panties,
Put
bitch.
On my panties, exactly. What kind of man are you if you're not going to fight for your kingdom, right?
Yeah.
Fight for your autonomy and your people. So she takes charge of an army of 5,000 soldiers, and they fight hard. They fight hard. There's a revolt and a siege led by the Queen Mother, and they took over the British fort at Kumasi, where Hodgson and his troops were stationed. The siege lasted several months, with both sides suffering significant casualties. The British eventually sent reinforcements to break the siege, despite their technological advantages, including a better weaponry. The British struggled against the determined Ashanti fighters. In the later stages of this war, the Queen was captured, along with other Ashanti leaders, and she was exiled to St. Chelles, where she remained until her death in 1921.
Oh, man.
But they put up a fight.
Yeah.
And she led the charge. The Ashanti people did not back down under her rule. She basically said, we're gonna give the British
a run for their money.
And we're going to try and kick them back out.
Yep.
But if you know anything about African history at this time, just after the 1900s, and especially after World War I, the whole country is broken up and colonized by the Europeans, except for Ethiopia, which was its own wealthy country and powerful country in Africa. So the outcome is a British victory. The British ultimately suppressed the rebellion and secured control over the Ashanti Empire. The Ashanti were forced to accept British rule, and their territories were incorporated into the British Gold Coast Colony. Now, the preservation of the Golden Stool, however, was managed by the Ashanti and kept out of British hands.
Well, that's good.
It was hidden. But the stool still remains a potent symbol of Ashanti identity and cultural heritage today. So the war is remembered as a significant act of resistance against colonial rule. I guess this could have went in our revolts and resistance and revolutions and resistance, whatever our last episode was. But Ya Asantewaa, the queen, is celebrated as a heroine and a symbol of African resistance and empowerment still today. The British strengthened their administrative and military presence in the region to prevent future uprisings. The incorporation of Ashanti territories into the Gold Coast Colony paved the way for eventual formation of modern Ghana. So, Ghana, a very gold-rich country, which is probably all mined by now. That's what pretty much the British helped to pave the way to it to be a modern-day country. But the War of the Golden Stool represents a critical episode in history of colonial Africa, illustrating the complex interactions between European colonial powers and indigenous African states, and it is a testament to the resilience and cultural pride of the Ashanti people.
Oh, well, I found where it's at.
Oh, it's somewhere.
It is. So it is in the Asante Royal Palace in Kumasi.
Oh, so it's in Kumasi.
It is.
Where we were just talking about, that's where the fort was.
Yes.
Oh, so.
And this also says the Ashanti chose to let the British exile their king instead of giving up the stool.
Oh, okay.
So they said, yeah, you can get rid of him because we're keeping our stool.
Ah, I must have missed that part.
Yeah.
Hey, look
at
you.
They didn't want to surrender it.
Being a historian. Good job.
No.
So yeah, they chose the stool.
This is from PBS.
It makes sense, though, but they gave up the stool, or they gave up the king rather than the stool, because that's how significant that stool is to their culture,
to
and I believe the king probably agreed to it. The king probably didn't want that stool to be gone either. He said, I'll take the exile over the, you know, a European power taking over our most prized piece of possessions that holds the souls of our ancestors.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
I just love her attitude.
Yeah, I love that.
She's a badass. Like, I love these stories because...
We love a badass woman.
Yeah, I do. And Africa, these people don't get enough credit. Everything is usually negative, usually always about slavery or something like that. But you don't realize until you actually look at African history how many strong people that there were.
Yeah.
That they tried. They tried their best to, especially in a case like this, try and defeat a large empire, a British European force. Luckily, like with the American Revolution, the colonists all had the same types of weapons as the British did because they were all British colonists.
Yeah.
In this case, it's two different societies. So it's harder. Totally. You don't have the same, you know, resources and weaponry as an African tribe, basically, right? The Ashanti tribe, than a powerhouse of a empire.
For sure.
So you're going to, that's why I think the American War of Independence is a little different in this case, because it just took the willpower to defeat the British, not the means.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And in this African case, in the Ashanti case, like, they needed more technological advanced weapons in order to even, like, probably take on the British.
Yeah, like, even have a chance.
But they're still, their tenacity and their drive, they tried to will it.
What is, like, Ghana like today? Is it one of those, like, poorer countries in Africa?
Ghana is actually not one of the poorer countries of Africa, I believe. And I believe Ghana, they speak English.
Oh.
Ghana has, if I'm not mistaken, Ghana has a very good relationship with the United States.
Okay.
And it's one of those English-speaking African countries that, like, you could go to and be safer in. Like, you could, like, I think there's people that go and visit Ghana all the time because it's one of those more secure, less conflicted countries.
Yeah.
Like, if you go to somewhere like Uganda, right? You go to like the Congo, the Sudan. Holy, yeah, the Sudan, Somalia. Like,
yeah, Somalia.
You never
that's
survive
not good,
there.
Right?
You would never survive there. As an American, you would never survive there. But I believe Ghana is one of those places that you can go to that would welcome you and you would be safe in.
Lower middle income economy.
So lower middle income, which is actually not bad when you're talking about African countries.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Yeah.
All right. So those are two stories of ridiculous conflicts. And like I said, they're a little ridiculous in a more serious way, I guess, than our previous ones about, you know, like a pig being killed. And emu taking over Australia.
I still can't believe that.
These are a little bit more serious issues or serious events that led to, you know, bigger conflicts. All right. Thank you all for coming back and listening this week. Sorry about last week again. We're back at it, though. Hope you enjoyed this episode. Go see some friends, family. Have a great weekend. Be safe. And we will talk to you next week.
See ya. Cheers.
Cheers.